You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet, here in my individual capacity entirely, and thank you for listening. We've had a number of requests for people to discuss the law involving tariffs, and we intend to do that. So we're starting our non-consecutive series on tariffs this week. And apparently, I have learned that tariffs are as old as the country itself, with the first round of tariffs having been issued around 1792. And for all I know, it could have been a year or two earlier as well. I am just not versed in that and couldn't find it. But I did find that Alexander Hamilton had written of protectionism in the interest of promoting manufacturing. You may notice this sounds like a familiar theme, but he penned that in 1792 in his report of the subject of manufactures. Sort of a different point of view was coming from James Madison, who favored open markets and free trade. Now, some of this I'm getting from a book by Frank William Taussig, who was a controversial guy. I think he believed in killing the poor because they were inconvenient and inferior, other super unattractive thoughts. But he is an American economist, and he was the author of The Tariff History of the United States. And the report written by Hamilton, which is a slog, let me tell you, written in the language of the times, will certainly make available in the notes because someone out there will actually read it as I did. And it wasn't the musical. Let me leave it at that. So beginning almost as soon as he was inaugurated, President Trump promised he would do this, and he did. He issued tariffs. So to talk to us tonight about tariffs and the legal framework that governs them or doesn't, our guest tonight is a professor at Georgetown University School of Law, Kathleen Clausen. Kathleen, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's just lay out the landscape where we are today. Now, bear in mind, we're recording on a Sunday. I would note that on Friday, tariffs that I thought were in place were lifted with respect to certain equipment for technology. Let's just set the stage right now at what we're looking at. What is the landscape on tariffs?
Okay, very briefly, because one could spend, of course, an extraordinary amount of time going through all the details, and we know they change by the minute. We had in February the introduction of tariffs on products from China, Canada, and Mexico in relation to an emergency that the president declared concerning fentanyl and drug importation. Then we had an announcement that there would be tariffs on steel and aluminum, and indeed those then followed in March. For all of these, there have been some suspensions and lifting of suspensions, so we won't get into the timeline so specifically, but those have been two big moves that were made in February. We then heard in late March there was going to be a 25% tariff on automobiles and certain automobile parts, with some exceptions, but those also came into effect eventually here earlier in April. Then the most important, I think, of course, what happened in the last 10 days, that is Liberation Day, as the president likes to call it, when he announced a 10% minimum tariff on products from countries the whole world over, as well as variable tariff rates, depending on which country a product is coming from. The 10% went into effect on the 5th of April. The variable rates on different countries went into effect on the 9th. But on the very same day that they went into effect, the president then paused them. And so those are now in a pause until the president changes his mind again. Maybe two small other things to add here, Elisa, is that throughout this period, as I said, they've been ups and downs. But one thing that's been going up, up, up are tariffs on products from China. And so China has retaliated. And so the president has put more and more tariff on those products. And secondly, to add that there are some exceptions to these I mentioned, and those change by the day as well. But we heard, and as you mentioned over the weekend here, that even though there are exceptions on things now like semiconductors or semiconductor containing products, that's only the opening salvo, because they're coming, according to the president's cabinet members, but they're coming in a different form later. So a lot of change. Those are the basics. We can't cover it all, but I hope that gives listeners a sense.
Thank you very much for that. Interesting. So shifting landscape, who knows? I think, well, frankly, I've seen sort of man on the street interviews. I think people don't even know what tariffs are.
Sure. So what we're talking about when we're talking about tariffs, which, as you point out, go back to the start of the nation, they're right there in the Constitution. They are the taxes that are put on goods that are brought into the country. So something that's imported, you pay the tariff at the border to bring it into the United States. Not everything is subject to one of them, but that's what the definition means.
So generally, who bears the cost? It's an incentive program, right? I think we have to characterize it some way. It's intended to have some impact, which is sort of what?
Well, it depends who you ask, right? So but let's just sort of very basically, in the early days of the nation, the whole point of having tariffs on products was to raise revenue for the country. And that's still a theme today. Certainly when that import comes in again at the border, it's the U.S. government that's collecting that money, right? So there's the revenue aspect. Now, what's controversial today and where maybe economists differ, but certainly there's a majority view that most companies, most importers, they are forwarding the cost of that tax to the consumer. So whoever's buying the end product, whoever's buying that thing, or maybe forwarding it on to a further thing, a widget of sorts, that cost gets passed on and potentially ultimately down to the consumer.
I found something interesting, which I guess I had forgotten. I didn't realize that at the time, we didn't really tax people. We did not have a tax service. So
right.
We didn't really have any way to build our infrastructure, build our roads, build our schools, short of tariffs.
That's right. There was no income tax until the early part of the 20th century. That's why tariffs were so important in the early days. And as you pointed out at the top, the Congress was eager to put down a, what we call a schedule of tariffs from the earliest days so that the nation could prosper.
But if I'm looking at Hamilton's, the title of his finding, white paper, I guess, for that period of time, it sounds like it was intended to promote onshoring, the manufacture of goods within the United States and the purchase thereof, with the idea that then industry would build, our economy would build, and then ultimately we would have a self-sustaining country. I mean, that seems like a great idea. Is that sort of how you read it?
You're absolutely right that there, again, in the early days, just like today, was some debate about just how much of these tariffs would force essentially manufacturing in the budding new nation. And today, the equivalent is how much would onshore bring back manufacturing to the United States? Because again, we're trying to avoid those costs. The producers are trying to avoid those costs that would be created by having a tariff on an imported good, right? So in turn, it seems it would be cheaper to make it at home. Actually, the interesting point from the early days to me, Elisa, if I may, is that what the Congress was concerned about at that time was making sure that each state was not doing its own tariff regime. That was actually part of the prompt for the Constitutional Convention, was to bring all the legislators together to say, hey, if we're going to succeed as a nation, we have to do this at the national level, at the federal level. And that's why in the Constitution, in Article 1, Section 8, you see that it assigns the tariff power as well as the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations to the Congress, very much a federalism point that the founders were concerned with at that time.
That's an interesting fact. And I also read, so obviously we need to all get on the same page. If we're going to be a country, act like a country. And I did also read that apparently tariffs were levied back and forth during the Civil War, something that had never even occurred to me would be happening. But in any event, President Trump's tariffs, of course, are hitting the 24-hour national and international news cycle. If you're picking up BBC or France 24, it's sort of an unending conversation about that. But we should point out that some other presidents have issued very wide and controversial tariffs as well. This is not fully owned by President Trump. It's happened before him. Can you talk a little bit about some of those or just refresh the memory of some of our listeners?
Sure. Maybe I'll take it one step farther back, if I may, just to illustrate how this evolved over time from that history that we just started with. So after the introduction of the income tax in the early part of the 20th century, this turn away from tariffs as the primary thing that we do, so to speak. And now there is a movement in that period in the last 100 years to do more free trade, to do more liberalization or reduce tariffs to zero, reduce tariffs down. Now, there were a lot of different ways that that happened, but the primary point is that from about the mid-1930s to today, we have been in this progressive liberalization period. So most presidents, most sessions of Congress have not been increasing tariffs. They've been going the opposite direction. They've been taking the really high tariffs that we had at the start of the 20th century and bringing them down. As you point out, there are some exceptions. One of them that's quite well known is that in 1971, President Nixon used powers that he had to impose a 10% tariff on all imports to the United States for several months in light of the economic crisis at that time. So that one we hear a lot about today because it sounds quite familiar. It sounds quite similar to what happened last week. And so the President Nixon experience is the one that I think most commentators would say is closest to what we're seeing today. And again, it was exceptional because the trend in the 30 years prior to that and in the 40, 50 years since has been really to reduce tariffs until we get to the first Trump administration, where again, the trend started to change once again.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the first Trump tariffs. And let's also talk about what President Biden didn't address and let stay, because I'm under the impression that while everybody's very excited right now, some of these things are really pretty consistent through various administrations.
Yes, well, they are for the last 8 years or so. That's true. So what we saw in the first Trump administration was, for the first time, the sort of dusting off of tariff authorities that hadn't been used since the Cold War. And when they were used during the Cold War, they were used relatively sparingly. So the first Trump administration used those authorities to impose tariffs on things like solar cells, the inputs to solar panels, as well as on products from China, as well as steel and aluminum, most notably. There were a few other things here and there, but those were the ones that stand out. Now, the tariffs on products from China, those were the ones that the Biden administration maintained. It made some changes somewhat on the margins, but maintained for the most part throughout the Biden administration. The steel and aluminum tariffs had a slightly more complicated background. Some of them were suspended. But again, the Biden administration did not make huge changes, nor did it impose many more tariffs, I think it's important to say. But it maintained many of the ones that the Trump administration, again, exceptionally after many years of not doing something like this, had imposed.
Let's talk about the legal authority for the president to do this, because you've mentioned that in the Constitution, and I believe you referenced Article 1, gave the authority for tariffs to Congress. What brought this legal authority within the sort of ambit, control, and powers of the presidency?
Again, the story goes back about 100 years ago when the Congress made this shift to this bringing tariffs down policy. Actually, what we see throughout the 20th century is a bifurcation in our laws. In every major trade law that was passed throughout the 20th century, mostly again in the Cold War period, Congress would delegate to the president authority to go negotiate free trade agreements. That is, again, to bring tariffs down through reciprocal agreements that we would conclude, including at the World Trade Organization, what would become the World Trade Organization in Geneva by the 1990s. So over those decades, you see Congress making these delegations to the president, basically go forth and conquer, go negotiate these deals, help bring our tariffs down vis-a-vis other countries bringing their tariffs down. And that was the primary theme. But in those same laws, there were also exceptions. And it's those exceptions that are now being activated today and over the last 8 years. The exceptions, each of them basically says the same thing. When the president finds it's in the interest of the nation, it's for national security, it's because the nation is being harmed or burdened or unfairly treated, the president can exceptionally raise tariffs. Again, throughout the 20th century, we have these delegations that on their face seem like liberalization statutes, encouraging the president to go negotiate tariffs down. But lurking in each of them is at least one provision that allows him to bring tariffs up when national security or some variation on national security, maybe it's a soft security reference or a hard security reference, so demands. And it leaves the president with the discretion to do that, to make that determination as to whether we're being harmed, burdened, or national security so requires. The last piece of the story is that when Congress made those exceptional delegations, allowing the president to raise tariffs, they did not include a great deal of oversight. While that wasn't a problem when they were used so sparingly during those Cold War years, of course, now today, that's taken on a greater spotlight. I'll just name these things for those who are reading the sort of more expert level literature on what's happening. We're talking about Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974. That's one of these authorities. That's the one that's used to allow the president to put tariffs on products from China. Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962. That's the one that we more commonly call the national security tariffs, because that's the one that was used for steel and aluminum and expressly refers to national security in there. There are others that have not yet been used, but among trade experts, we think could be possibly used in the future. And then, of course, the biggest one that we'll need to spend some time on is the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. That's the one that's now in the greatest area of attention.
What is it about IEEPA that has proven to be different from those other legal tools that you talked about that were enacted in 1962 and 1974?
Well, a few things. IEEPA, of course, is not one of these exceptions embedded in another trade law. It's its own law. And again, I think listeners will be familiar with that because it's been used in so many other ways in our international economic law toolkit over the last several decades. It also had a predecessor law that, again, listeners may be familiar with, the Trading with the Enemy Act. It was that law that was the one that was relied upon by President Nixon for the tariffs I mentioned earlier in 1971. And so that's relevant because now with President Trump relying on IEEPA, people are looking back to President Nixon's use of the predecessor law, the TWEA, in 71 and making some comparisons. Lastly, it's relevant because it doesn't include the word tariff or duty or anything equivalent to that. In fact, what it says is that the president may regulate importation or exportation. At least that's the language that comes closest to what we might think of as a tariff authority. Those are the principal takeaways for what's happening right now with respect to how it's being used. Again, I think listeners know that the process is the president declares a national emergency with respect to some threat from outside the United States, which he has done. And then that activates, right, allows him to use these other authorities. But one last thing, if I may, Elisa, just to add that across all these statutes that I've mentioned, there are maybe two points that are worth flagging if people leave with nothing else. One is that some of them give the power directly to the president to do this tariff raising work. And some of them, by contrast, give that power to an agency. Now, of course, that is relevant because if the president has that power, he is subject to a different set of checks and balances, arguably many fewer, than if an agency has the power. And so we could talk about litigation, but to the extent we get to litigation, there are arguably many more checks and balances on the agency's work in this respect than there are on the president's work. So that's important, is to highlight that some of these exceptions go directly to the president, like IEEPA. That's something that, you know, the president can do without agency support, so to speak, whereas others of them go through an agency process. The second thing, big takeaway here, is that some of these authorities give the president and agencies the power to put tariffs on individual products, whereas others allow him to put tariffs on products from individual countries. You'll see that different authorities are used to tackle different issues. We talked about products from China. Section 301 speaks in terms of what a country is doing. A country is doing a bad thing to hurt us. So we're going to put tariffs on products from that country. The whole, anything we want coming from that country can be done under Section 301. When we're talking about Section 232, that's product specific. There it's steel and aluminum or semiconductors or cars, right? And so we pick a particular import that is harming our national security and the tariff goes on that. And of course, we know IEEPA, that's the big broad one. And so there the president is doing it on a countrywide basis as well. So just again, I think those two points are important for listeners to take away.
Okay. And just for our listeners, you know, IEPA is the statute that we have discussed in the past when we've talked about sanctions against particular threatening regimes. And in this context, it's not coextensive with the trade conversation, but it's sort of being brought into a trade conversation without saying, oh, this country is fill in the blank, a terrorist sponsor, or whatever we ordinarily see in this area. But let's talk about some of the restrictions on some of these statutes in terms of potentially, not necessarily, but potentially cabining, I guess, not the president's authority, but maybe the duration of these tariffs. And when I say duration, I'm going to assume that there's some review process if there is a closing date for any tariff, because, you know, we live in a very big, fast-moving world, but the passage of time comes quickly. And I imagine that there might be factual findings or something that would allow a president, say, extend a tariff. What does that look like in the law?
You would think there would be something like that. And indeed, there are time constraints and various findings required for some of these, but again, not for all of them. Things that go through agencies generally have those sorts of, let's call them guardrails built in, whereas IEPA is, of course, devoid of those sorts of things. There is in IEPA, right, a one-year clock at which time the president renews the emergency. And I say that as a sort of a given because many of the national emergencies connected up to IEPA actions in the past have been renewed without much fanfare. Of course, there are emergencies that have been in place for several decades. So that's not much of a constraint, I think it's fair to say, when it comes to things like the tariffs. But I think your broader takeaway of your question, Lisa, was that no, IEPA has not been used in this way before, only the predecessor statute in the Nixon days in a cabined way. So I think that's important to note that this really has such a broad impact and the president can do so much with it because those guardrails are not there. There is now some legal debate about just how much the guardrails apply in those other cases of the other tariffs, the Section 301 tariffs, the Section 232 tariffs. We're talking about findings that were made by the first Trump administration now many years ago. And so some would say we need new findings, right? Or you can't rely on that old information, or too much time has passed. You can't make modifications. Those are sort of natural responses to something that is now so much time has passed. The courts that had an opportunity to review some of those tariff actions from the first Trump administration have been very deferential with respect to what the president can modify, what the president can do with those findings now, many years into the future, to the extent that we might expect that we need to do more findings or you need more process. The courts so far have not been leaning in that direction. The courts are largely siding with the government on most of the tariff actions that we've seen to date. Again, talking about the tariff actions from the first Trump term.
When you refer to the president having the authority to do the tariffs or to issue the tariffs, and then you talk about agencies, we have a U.S. trade rep, but when you refer to agencies, can we be specific so people understand which agencies we refer to and what you refer to by the agency process, since not everybody listening to this will clearly understand what that process looks like?
Sure. The trouble is that it's different for each authority. The agencies that are relevant to this story are mostly the U.S. Trade Representative's Office, as well as the Commerce Department. Those are front and center because USTR has that Section 301 power. It's assigned to USTR in the statute. And likewise, the Commerce Department, it's the Secretary of Commerce that has the power with those Section 232 tariffs. So to the extent those are the two most important three-digit statutes that we have been used to date, and they are, those are the two agencies that we're talking about. The process that each agency uses to reach a determination with respect to these tariffs is a little different depending on which of those two statutes we're talking about. But I think the bottom line is that they each have to do an investigation and produce a report and give that to the president. Then the president has the final call on whether or not to put tariffs or take some other action. It's also worth noting that although this particular White House is interested in tariffs above all, these authorities allow these agencies and the president to do other things in our trade space as well. But we'll put that to one side. The bottom line is they do some sort of investigation, which they can or may not include a hearing. They can collect comments from the outside world, so to speak, and then they produce this report. Even if they say there's harm here, the country is being harmed, the president could choose to not take action as well. Although, of course, we have not seen that yet from this particular administration.
Okay, well, let's move on. Have there been legal challenges to tariffs that have been issued by the president alone, given the fact that that is described as an Article I authority? And let's talk about what the historical context was for those challenges as well.
Sure. So we can start back at the Nixon tariffs. When President Nixon's authority was challenged under the TWIA, the Trading with the Enemy Act, that 10% tariff on all imports to the United States, the federal appellate court that reviewed that action ultimately ruled in President Nixon's favor. The court looked at the plain language of the TWIA, which again, like the IEEPA, empowers the president to regulate importation. And the court interpreted this language as a broad delegation of authority, one that at that time authorized the president to regulate imports in any manner that the Congress itself could pursue, including imposition of tariffs. That's the closest we have to some sort of precedent for what is happening now with respect to the IEEPA tariffs. And of course, as you know, we have many different tariffs at play. I will mention that there are, as of today, Sunday, the 13th of April, there are three cases that have been filed against the tariffs that have been imposed in the last 2 months. Those cases have to do with the tariffs imposed under IEEPA, but under the emergency declarations related to fentanyl and the importation of illegal drugs, again, from the earliest days of this year. Those are tariffs on products from Canada, Mexico, and China. So we have some litigation that's just begun that will presumably draw on the distinctions between the IEEPA and the TWIA to say that that case involving President Nixon is not controlling here, and that actually this use of IEEPA to deal with a fentanyl crisis is not appropriate, and or tariffs are not appropriate. And then some of those arguments are now coming to the fore as those cases proceed. There are also a series of cases that have challenged the Trump 1.0 tariffs. As I mentioned, at that time, the courts have largely deferred to the president to use Section 301 and to use Section 232 in the way that he has used those two statutes. And I may just add here, because I think for your podcast in particular, it's important to note the way that the government has defended these actions. The Department of Justice represents the Commerce Department and the USTR in the Court of International Trade, where most of these cases get filed. From there, they get appealed to the Federal Circuit. And although the importers have had some wins with respect to process, with respect to the Administrative Procedure Act, and the way investigations or exemptions have been done, the big picture takeaway when they get appealed to the Federal Circuit has been that the government is winning on those sort of big ticket items. Can he do this? Can he use these statutes as he has wanted to do and as he has done? And the Department of Justice, when it has come into the courtroom to make these arguments, it really has emphasized something that I think makes some of us commentators a bit uncomfortable. And my colleague Tim Meyer and I have written about this. The executive branch is drawing on a blurry space in its arguments between foreign affairs and foreign commerce. And it's coming in there and saying to the court, hey, yes, these are delegated authorities. Yes, these are statutory authorities that Congress has given to the executive under Congress's Article I power. But it's getting mixed with the president's Article II powers, because this is all wrapped up with national security. So the executive branch is making arguments in court to defend these tariffs where it claims independent constitutional authority over foreign commerce. It's saying this foreign affairs and foreign commerce, these two pieces really cannot be divorced from one another. You can see it because it's a national security issue. And therefore, court, the normal statutory limits do not bind the president as they might in some other circumstances. So those sorts of arguments we've seen already in the last several years, we expect them to continue. And that makes some of us think that to the extent the courts continue to accept them, that the president will be successful in maintaining much of his tariff program.
I'm trying to play devil's advocate for just a minute here. When we talk about blurry space, I think some of that is a function of the structure of the government in terms of the executive branch having access to the classified information and intelligence collection to develop an opinion or some sort of persuasive authority to support the notion that any sort of trade is really part of a bigger strategy, perhaps. You know, there's no lobby for fentanyl producers really as such, right? They're not going to come in and file the lawsuit. But in terms of the first thing you say out of the gate, talk about a persuasive topic in order to win public support. I mean, actually, in terms of playing your cards, this seems pretty brilliantly calculated, because who is going to say, you know, I've walked down Embarcadero in San Francisco and I don't see a fentanyl problem. You can't even get to the ferry boats because the bodies are just strewn all over the place. And I think the fentanyl crisis has been felt so deeply in America, rural and urban, everywhere, that to cite that as the first emergency out of the gate, I can see why a court would say, okay, this is a national security crisis. So it's very interesting to hear you say that. And it also makes me think that this was a really clever strategy to make this the first one. But who's going to appeal? I guess Mexico, right? Some law firm would be representing Mexico and say this is having adverse impact on trade. And somebody's going to be representing Canada. And then the long line of precedent is largely favoring the government.
Well, the entities that are most likely to have standing to bring these cases are the importers. So importers, as you point out, they have standing because they can say that the cost of these tariffs, right, is putting me out of business. That situates them well to be able to say irreparable harm, right? We need an injunction, stop the tariffs now. So that's the sort of traditional plaintiff that you see before the Court of International Trade and say, hey, I'm an importer, I'm in big trouble. You need to help me, court, because the president has gone off the rails with respect to a particular statute. Now, the second piece of what you said is, I think, where a lot of trade lawyers are now spending their time. And that is with respect to what part of this action do you challenge? As you point out, okay, there's a fentanyl crisis, right? President Biden put Mexico and China on the list of countries that were particularly bad for this reason. Canada maybe is a harder case to make, but in any event, at least those two, the last administration would agree with you, right? It's a bipartisan support for the fact that there is a problem with the importation of goods that contain or somehow are leading to fentanyl trafficking. So that's maybe not the aspect that you challenge, but maybe for the new tariffs that are based on this fact that we have a trade deficit, maybe there you do take up the emergency itself. So you could challenge the nature of the emergency, what's being claimed as an emergency under the National Emergencies Act, that's step one of the IEEPA process. Many would suggest you could challenge the relationship between the emergency and this remedy to say that they're not related enough, the fentanyl problem or the trade deficit problem and these tariffs. That's not an appropriate remedy under IEEPA and under the National Emergencies Act. There are other legal theories out there that IEEPA needs to be clear, so they have a non-delegation problem, you have a major questions doctrine problem. Oh, there's a reasonably long list that now lawyers are readily debating. But I think, again, your point is a good one in that you have to be quite selective as to how you approach this, because otherwise you're going to find yourself facing a Department of Justice that's going to play that same card again and say, hey, this is foreign affairs, you can't touch this. President's doing what he can totally and is longstanding, has history of doing, that is being presidential and running the diplomacy of the United States.
Good. And let's say that's the national court section in case somebody is interested in that line of work. You mentioned the principle of non-delegation. I mean, what I found interesting about your sudden reference to that is I believe that was something that Antonin Scalia didn't love. And he is a person oft-cited by a lot of people in the administration for statements he made regarding separation of powers and sort of unitary executive. But I mean, he wasn't a huge fan of Congress delegating its authorities to the president.
Yeah, so the non-delegation challenges will come. I'm sure that that litigation is forthcoming. It hasn't been a primary argument in the cases that have been filed so far. There was a non-delegation case involving those Section 232 steel and aluminum tariffs from the first Trump term that was not successful. The Supreme Court denied cert in that case. And so we haven't seen the Supreme Court at least sort of biting on that invitation to look at these tariff authorities in that way. Again, I think for me and for my colleagues who are thinking about this deeply, we see all three branches of government playing a role in setting up the moment in which we find ourselves. Right? We see on the one hand, this vast foreign commercial bureaucracy across many agencies, particularly USTR and the Commerce Department, making these incredible claims on behalf of this trade administrative state. We see the courts buying into this securitization, constitutionalization argument that the executive branch is putting forward. And of course, the Congress, we haven't talked a lot about apart from them in a historical sense, they are the ones that have the power most readily, so to speak, to take action here to roll back some of these delegations and that inaction for the last 8 years to reclaim any foreign commerce authority is now becoming increasingly clear.
2 points on that. I wonder if I were the first litigant, it could be Chipotle, right? They get 80% of the avocados in the world, and now they're going to have to raise prices. Maybe that would be attractive plaintiff. It certainly would if my 14-year-old was making the decision. But back to the issue of Congress, I do have to wonder, as I'm talking to you, Kathleen, and I'm thinking about this for a moment, I think part of the problem that we have with Congress is they're all responsible to different constituencies who have disparate sort of equities when it comes to what might be the subject of tariffs. You know, if you are in a state that produces one particular kind of crop or you need a particular kind of thing to manufacture a vehicle, you may have one point of view. And perhaps reaching some sort of consensus is something they recognized they could not do. And so they abdicated that role to the president, or we were in a Cold War or otherwise facing unique global challenges. And they felt legitimately at the time that giving this authority to the president because of what maybe they perceived as a gas permeable membrane between trade and these foreign government actions or foreign threats was just a fact of our global life, that separating the two was a bit of an artifice. So I do wonder about those things. And I wonder if you've thought about those things. It sounds like you've given an enormous amount of thought, but I'd like to sort of draw you out on that before we close out tonight.
Sure. So absolutely right in that the 20th century, there was an active effort. That's why we see all these delegations to avoid interest group capture in Congress, to stop the sort of inability of Congress to make the detailed level decisions of the tariff code sort of go piece by piece, product by product, give that to the executive branch where there's a great deal of expertise. And so first to the State Department, and then eventually the creation of the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, which according to its founding statute, really works for both Congress and the president. Although it sits in the executive office of the president, Congress has been very clear that Congress is USTR's client. Representative Kevin Brady made that point in a hearing with Ambassador Lighthizer, the former USTR. And so USTR should be responsive to what Congress is telling it, right? But it has the job to go do the negotiations, but it needs to hear and get input from members of Congress, who the flip side, of course, of your different equities point is their representation. They are the front line of conversation with constituents. They are bringing those concerns to the executive to be addressed. So that's the historical side. What we're seeing now is those constituents voicing concern in part about retaliation that they're facing, right? If you particularly look at the farm country, right? You see there large amounts of retaliation against exports, markets being closed for U.S. exports in different parts of the world. And so bringing those concerns to Congress now, members of Congress are saying, hey, you know, pay attention again here. You're not listening to us. You've gone too far. And we've started to see some bills again being introduced with some success in the Senate so far. We saw this 6 years ago, if I'm honest, Elisa, and we didn't get over the finish line with any of them. Obviously, this is much more extreme than what we saw in the first term. And so maybe this time we will see Congress act moving with this momentum that actually what's happening now is too chaotic for the country to withstand.
We have some international agreements that must be upended by this. And I wanted to ask you just briefly to talk about some of those.
Yes, 100%. As many would say, they're not worth the paper they're written on at this stage, because the whole point of our free trade agreements, right, is to bring those tariffs to zero between those countries, or near zero, on the goods that we circulate, often, at least in North America, among those trading partners. And so all of those trade agreements are clearly non-operational in the sense that those tariffs have now been put on those countries, equally to other countries with whom we don't have trade agreements. There are other parts of trade agreements that may be still somewhat useful. That is, to the extent they deal with non-tariff barriers, we still cooperate on a regulatory basis with those trading partners. But when it comes to the crux of the whole free trade agreement program, there's no question that these fly in the face of everything that's been negotiated in the past.
I think when these things happen, it generates a certain interest and excitement among young lawyers who are watching sort of the impact of this. I mean, it is literally on Canada Broadcasting, France 24, BBC, round the clock, Deutsche Television. I mean, they're watching this and they're probably saying, wow, this could be an exciting area of practice. What advice might you have for them? What should they be pursuing or thinking about? And maybe thinking, where would they like to work as they develop this expertise, or a place to acquire that expertise?
Well, it is no doubt an exciting time, but for some of us, maybe a little too exciting. This is a moment when we're not getting a lot of sleep, in part because things are changing so quickly, as is obvious to everyone. But I agree, there is a lot of work to be done. And I always tell my students that these are the most exciting times, indeed, to be engaged in international economic law, even if feel like we're fighting against the current. Places to work, there are plenty of trade boutiques that do this type of work. I'm not sure that many government agencies, normally I would recommend going to a government agency, but the only one that I know of that's hiring so readily is the Customs and Border Protection Agency. So that would be a place to go to get one's feet wet in this space. And then there are, you know, a handful of training opportunities that Georgetown offers, for example, at our Institute of International Economic Law. So for those who want to pivot into this area, if you're already in practice but want to learn more, come check out everything that we have to offer at the Institute. And you can get in a short course, basically an executive ed program, a lot of the basics that you need to be able to be conversant and succeed in a practice related to international trade and customs.
I'm really glad you came in and educated us tonight, Kathleen.
Thank you so much.
Best of luck in your pursuits.
Thank you so much.
All right. And thank you for listening to NSLT. Be sure to give us a rating on your listening app of choice and share this podcast with a friend. We're committed to bringing you cost-free, intelligent content that will enrich you and make you definitely the smart person at the party, or at least be able to talk to the smartest person at the party. And you'll also probably be smarter than most of your friends. Isn't that what you want? You kind of bring everybody up. We would advise you to do one thing. Hear other people's opinions in this moment. We live in a time of extreme points of view, not always fact-based, and much driven by algorithms on social media. And when you listen to a podcast like this and you can get the facts and the law and understand a little bit, I think this brings us a little closer together, even if we do not agree on topics. And that is a very important part of being a lawyer as well, which is hearing the other side's view, hearing what their arguments are, and being able to respond to those. Because let's face it, if you miss something in their argument, you're not going to be the greatest lawyer. So we really appreciate you listening tonight, and we hope you get a chance to talk to your friends and colleagues about our podcast and about the topics we discussed today. We'll be back next week with another content-filled podcast, and we hope to see you then. Our producer, writer, and host is me, Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity and no other. Our editor and my co-producer is Francis Burkham. My other co-producer is the hardworking, amazing Holly McMahon, and all the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.